Cancel your summer holidays. Cancel Bill Gates. It's time for another Flat Chat. I'm Stuart Codling, and the August issue of our August organ has landed. GP Racing is on the newsstands this week, and joining me to dig deeper into what we've been up to this month are Mark Gallagher, not on your boat this month, Mark.
No, I'm actually made it back to the UK, and I'm at home in my office, and very happy to be here.
You dodged all those torpedoes, you haven't had to self-isolate.
Do you know what? Please don't tell Priti Patel this, but I sailed from Bordeaux all the way back to England, went in at Brighton, Ramsgate and London, and was never once asked by anybody where I'd come from, whether I had any passengers, and would I like to show them my passport. So much for immigration control.
Global Britain.
Yeah, sounds like the experience a lot of our colleagues had when coming back through Heathrow from Hungary, and where they weren't even asked to show their paperwork. But anyway, we have another voice on the line. Someone who, and it's a bit bizarre, like me, has had to write a race report in the last few weeks because we are back racing again. It's Ben Anderson. What's it been like, Ben, writing? You were on pole position for the first race report of the year.
I was, yeah. What an honour. I had to dust down the TV, get my logins back together, start taking notes on races. Strange experience to kind of be there and not be there at the same time.
While a lot has changed in terms of how the racing is organised in Formula One, not much has changed in terms of Lewis Hamilton being king of the castle. And increasingly, he's now using his profile and star power to be a force for positive social change, which is why we've gone for a quite striking visual treatment on the cover of this issue. And obviously, there are some people who might not like it. There are people who say sport and politics shouldn't mix. There are other people who'd say it's not politics. And we can dig into that right now, because Mark, you've written the cover feature. How challenging was it to actually approach a subject matter like that, which is kind of inherently polarizing?
Yeah, I must say, when Ben very kindly gave me the challenge of writing this feature, it felt rather like being handed a hand grenade with the pin already pulled out and told, just go and do something with that. So it was actually hugely enjoyable and perhaps even more educational to spend some days working through everything that's been going on in Lewis Hamilton's world, in Formula One's world, and to talk to, I had a chat with Nicholas Hamilton, Lewis's brother as well, because I wanted to kind of really get a feel for what the issues have really been in the Hamilton family during those important formative years. And Lewis refers to it quite openly about the bullying and the racism that he received at school. And so I found the whole kind of research for the feature very interesting and educational for me. And then also to see what other people think. And you very correctly pointed out, Stuart, you know, this front cover will, I think, wind some people up, because there is a lot of negativity around the Black Lives Matter campaign that Lewis has been supporting, the taking the knee before Grand Prix, and the mess that was being made of that in Formula One, particularly in Hungary, also in the second Austrian race, but particularly in Hungary. So it's been a very controversial subject. People have reacted to it in lots of different ways. In a nutshell, my view came to be that Lewis is absolutely correct to put his head over the parapet, because he is Britain's superstar Formula One driver. He is black. He is absolutely right when he says there is not going to be another black Formula One driver anytime soon, not in the next 10 years, probably not in the next 20 years. And we have to ask ourselves why that is. And of course, there's a lot of pushback, because some people will say, well, it's because not enough black people try to do Formula One. You have people like Mario Andretti, Jackie Stewart, Bernie Eccleston being interviewed and, you know, coming off with all kinds of statements about Formula One not really being racist. And it's just, you know, racism isn't really a problem in the sport. And yet, when you zoom right out, you have to say it is beholden to black sports stars and, you know, celebrities to use their platform to raise this absolutely valid problem that exists in society around the world, which is that so much of what we see and consume continues to be white and male dominated. There is a lack of diversity, and for the black community particularly, there are clearly some very profound challenges. So when you kind of wrap the whole thing up, you have to say Lewis is doing the right thing. And as I said in the feature, as I go on to write in the feature, you know, the FIA and Formula One have been very quick to support him in so many ways, but there's still a lot of work to be done to get this right.
I thought your entry point was very interesting, and I was reminded of it last night when there was a lady interviewed on the news who was the principal of a school in Bristol, and she spoke of situations where it's not overt racism, but there's a sort of an unthinkingness to it, and she described it as almost microaggressions, where she gets people who just think she's a teaching assistant and doesn't realise she's the principal. And I thought that sort of chimed with your entry point, which is that in Hollywood, you get the magical black character, don't you, who's sort of this otherworldly figure, and it's as if Hollywood feels that's the only way they can kind of smuggle a black person into the fiction as a major character, by having them being this sort of almost otherworldly kind of person. So it's very odd, isn't it?
It sure is. And you know, I mean, I like the fact you've just given another little example there. I have one which I've come across very recently, where actually someone who I know quite well knocked on the front door of someone's house, and it was opened by a black lady, and his first comment to her was, "Are you the cleaner?" And she was actually the tenant. When you think about just assumptions, but the racism is coming through from just many, many years of a cultural mindset being developed. And I think what's really quite extraordinary is when you sit down, I spent days going through lots of material online, watching news reports, watching videos, watching films, listening to people on all sides of this debate, from one extreme, quite frankly, to the other extreme, and yet coming to the conclusion that here is a problem, and that it's kind of been unspoken in Formula One for ever such a long time. Really, the fact that Lewis is black doesn't really get discussed, hasn't been really discussed. It kind of gets mentioned maybe in passing. But it's kind of become such a big focus, of course, now since the Black Lives Matter campaign really accelerated in the wake of the death of George Floyd, apparently at the hands of the police, obviously, in the US. And Lewis's response, I think, as well, has maybe generated something of a negative reaction among some fans in Europe, because they don't actually get the degree to which Lewis associates himself with American culture, and particularly black American culture. And he's got absolutely every right to do that. If he feels comfortable there, he likes black American culture in terms of music, in terms of fashion, he spends a lot of time there. Why should he not spread the message through the role that he has in Formula One? And it is the preeminent role. You know, he's not a guy turning up qualifying 14th on the grid and you know, hoping to score some points. Here's a guy who's headlong rushing towards his seventh world championship title. And, you know, as you mentioned, Stuart, you know, at the beginning of my article, I referred to this, you know, magical black character, which was identified by the film director Spike Lee. He did a number of lectures in universities in the US back in 2001, and he pointed out how often when you're watching a Hollywood film, the black character has to be someone with kind of almost near magical qualities, and be it, you know, Will Smith as Matt Damon's kind of mystical golf caddy in The Ledger of Bagger Vance, or you know, could be Cuba Gooding Jr. in Robin Williams' film What Dreams May Come, and almost anything that features Morgan Freeman. When you actually look at Morgan Freeman's career, you know, he's played God at least twice, and he's been president of the United States a number of times. It's almost like he's got the voice for, but the point that Spike Lee makes is that so often the black characters, when they come in, they can't just be a normal person. They have to have some kind of superhuman, supernatural quality to them. And actually, inevitably, it becomes a way of making predominantly white audiences feel, oh, you know, black people are fine, you know, and they've got some kind of magical quality that they can bring to us rather than just being a normal person. And I think that, you know, once it's pointed out, and I'm sure listeners of the podcast will kind of recognize this, but all I will say is once you're introduced to that notion of the sort of magical black character in the world of entertainment, you will be astonished how many films, how many series you will watch, and you will see this coming out time and time again. And so there's so much to what we're going through at the moment that really requires education for white people. And I quote in my article the former West Indies fast bowler Michael Holding, who gave a fabulous interview to Sky Sports. And he was asked about the Black Lives Matter campaign, because a lot of people say Black Lives Matter is a terrorist organization, which it's not, wants to defund the police, which only some supporters of Black Lives Matter want to see the police in the United States refunded in terms of how they're financially supported. But Michael Holding actually gives a brilliant interview in which he talks about the fact that black people all know that white lives matter. He gets quite animated about the fact that people throw back at him, all lives matter. And this is something I've seen online being posted against Lewis. You know, Lewis, don't, you know, why are you promoting Black Lives Matter? All lives matter. The all lives matter thing is a way of swerving the issue. The issue is that white lives have always mattered, and black lives absolutely demonstrably, if you look at any of the statistics, clearly matter significantly less. And whether that's through police brutality in the United States, which is definitely swayed against the black community, if you look at the statistics, and of course here in Europe we see similar statistics come through, whether it's when you talk to someone like John Amici, who is a British former NBA player. I met him about a year and a half ago. I remember having lunch with him. I mean, here's a guy, 6'7", incredibly well-educated, very articulate, runs a fabulous business in London. He retrained as a psychologist after his sporting career came to an end. He lives in Covent Garden. He's an absolutely fantastic guy. He gets stopped and searched, he reckons, about four times a year. That's never happened to me. I don't know if it's ever happened to you guys, but I mean, I don't walk through London seeing policemen walking towards me thinking, oh, they might stop me and, you know, check me out for drugs or something. It just doesn't happen. So these become the really sort of brutal, thorny issues at the centre of this debate. And again, zooming back out, kind of looking at Formula One's response to it, I think, first of all, Liberty as Formula One were absolutely correct to come out with an initiative. I think We Race Is One slightly swerves the you know, Lewis's campaign. It's a clever way of kind of saying to Lewis, look, we're doing something, but it doesn't specifically address racism. Talks about diversity. Obviously the racism is addressed in the statements that they made, but the We Race Is One, ever such as there's a slight bit of fudge on that. The FIA came out with a very strong statement, actually, in the wake of the initial protests after the George Floyd death in the US. And the FIA have always, over the years, been very clear about you know, motorsport being for all. But when you look at what then happened at the second Grand Prix in Austria, the Styrian Grand Prix, with, you know, the taking the knee ceremony just really mishandled. And then definitely in Hungary, mishandled again. And drivers late, drivers not taking the knee, lots of confusion, lots of commentary online. Even Formula One's own TV director at times not quite knowing how to deal with, you know, this moment before the race, which is clearly something that Lewis has decided to do this season. And somewhere along the line, you really feel like Formula One needed to sit down with all the team principals, with all the drivers, and say, we need to put on a unified view here. Does anyone actually have a problem with it? Now, apparently, none of them do have a problem with supporting anti-racism, and none of them have a problem with stating that they're against racism, but they appear to have a problem with visually being seen to support Lewis's campaign. And that's a pity, because Lewis represents the focal point for this, whether other drivers like it or not.
Yeah, it shows that Formula One's got a way to go, I think, in terms of understanding. And you use the word education in your explanation, Mark. I think that's really important. If you compare how Formula One has looked in handling this compared to, say, Premier League football, there's a big disconnect in terms of the unity of the message. And of course, in football, unfortunately, I think a lot, not only is that sport more diverse in its makeup of players, but many of those players have experienced racism on the pitch from fans, from fellow players. So then other players, teammates of theirs who haven't experienced it directly, have experienced it through their teammates and have probably a better understanding of the scourge of it. And it's probably then therefore been easier for that league to come together and all do the same unified anti-racist message before every match. Whereas in Formula One, where there is such a greater lack of diversity in terms of the participants, I think they're just ignorant of the issue. Lewis is the only one who's experienced this. He's asking people to put themselves in his shoes and understand his experience and the experience of others from his background. And they can't do it. It's not easy. It's very difficult to put yourself in someone else's shoes. And it's, I think, a problem that's exacerbated in the modern world as well, where everyone's kind of the centre of their own universe and living in almost their own Truman Show on social media. But nevertheless, it needs to be done. And it's not so much that Formula One is racist, as some of the old guard you mentioned being interviewed have said. It's that they're non-racist, as John Amici in your article describes. They're uncomfortable about the situation, but they don't recognise it. They don't see it. What Lewis is asking from his peers and from the sport itself is to become anti-racist and actively against that discrimination. And that's the leap that Formula One is trying to make, I believe, but is struggling with, I think, purely through a lack of education.
Actually, in not taking this the knee, I feel they're making a statement. Taking the knee is such an easy thing to do. And it essentially says, I'm in agreement with Lewis Hamilton that racism is a blight on society and there's no place for it, including in Formula One. And then, of course, people have said, well, including Lewis, Lewis has had to say, well, I'm not going to judge anyone for not taking the knee. I judge people for not taking the knee. When I see that on TV, I think, what's going on in your head? What's going on in your team principal's head that you haven't had a little chat and said, I think we actually need to get behind Lewis on this. It's the right thing to do. And the moment you roll back on that and say, actually, no, well, it's my right not to take the knee. I'm just going to stand there with an anti-racism T-shirt on. I really don't know what you, literally, I don't know what you're standing for. I don't know what you stand for, because you're wearing a T-shirt, but you're not prepared to take the knee. And so I feel that the whole thing has been badly mismanaged. And I mean, I don't want to name names here, but I know some of the individuals involved in teams and amongst drivers. And I'm hugely uncomfortable with the fact that drivers were not taking the knee or made to take the knee, because actually, when it comes down to it, there is a kind of latent racism and actually perhaps privately an overt racism that exists among some people within our sport, just as there is an inherent sexism within certain areas of our sport. And of course, no one's going to come out and say, well, actually, I'm just a little bit racist, you know, like my uncle or something, you know, he's just a bit racist, you know. Nobody's going to come out and say that. But you only have to look at the comments that have been made to say by the elder statesman of racing. And I agree with you, Ben. It's not the, I don't think Bernie Ecclestone's racist. I certainly would not think Mario Andretti or Jackie Stewart are racist. But they don't understand, because they've never actually been in that position. And if you do spend a few days watching the videos, talking to people, having a chat with Nicholas Hamilton about, you know, what used to happen when they turned up as a black family in their Vauxhall Cavalier at a kart race in England, and the looks that they would get and the suspicion that they would get. And then when you talk to Lewis about the things that he went through, actually you come away feeling incredibly uncomfortable. Here is something that before anyone passes a comment on, the biggest argument you have to win is against your own prejudices, is to actually sit down and say, here are my opinions and then set about questioning them. Because once you question everything and start looking into the facts of it, I mean, you know, Google the UK Home Office crime statistics on stop and search for police. I mean, you read a couple of pages of it and you come away and think, you know, why am I not aware of this more often? And the answer is, if you're white, you don't ever come up against it.
Do you think that to an extent that a lot of people talk about things, share information, or deliver a hot take on social media about things without actually having read or understood what they're actually talking about? And I would lump Bernie's thing in with that. He said something stupid to CNN, and then the Daily Mail just rattled him in. It was a typical tabloid sting, wasn't it? The Daily Mail said, "Oh, Bernie, would you like to have right of reply?" And they knew he'd dig himself further in while trying to rebut what he'd already said.
But I mean, it's so easy. Such an easy clickbait headline on any topic you care to think about is go and get an 89-year-old former boss of Formula One to do an interview with you about some sensitive current topic. A, he's not going to be sensitive about it. B, he's probably not going to be that up to date on it. And you'll get your headline. And I think, you know, the interview he did with Amanda for CNN, you have to say, why did they go and talk to him? What relevance does it have to ask an 89-year-old former boss of Formula One anything? Because he's not here. And as Lewis said in his sort of rebuttal, you know, Bernie's part of the history of the sport. He's not part of the current sport of Formula One. And, you know, we all have a lot of respect for what Bernie achieved. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, that conversation is irrelevant to what we're talking about today. What we're talking about today are young black school children and undergraduates who would perhaps really like to follow Lewis Hamilton into Formula One because he has acted as an inspiration for them that actually a black person can be successful in our sport. And therefore the sport absolutely has to make sure that those mechanics and marketing people and hospitality people and PR officers, and because it applies to every area of Formula One. You know, there's this thing about Lewis is the only black driver. Where is our black press officer in Formula One? Where is our black hospitality manager? Where is our black pit crew mechanic? Where is... And when people say, well, you know, what are you going to do? Are you going to kind of fix it that there has to be a certain number of black people? No, you're not going to fix it that there are going to be a certain number of black people. But what you are going to do is you're going to say, everyone is welcome. Everyone will get equal opportunity. And when everyone who is interviewed for a job walks into that room, irrespective of their colour or creed, they will have equal opportunity to get that role in the sport. And based on the evidence that we have at the moment, that is not the case. And that's why this is such an important matter. And therefore, you cannot blame Lewis for, you know, for banging the drum as loudly as he is.
Yeah, absolutely. The starting point is recognising that it's a whitewashed sport, isn't it? And there's also a lot of whataboutery in this kind of debate, if you want to call it that. You hear it's making people uncomfortable and they wish Lewis would just shut up and stick to his racing, which is obviously what we've talked about on the cover. And I think it's good that it's making people feel uncomfortable because it's supposed to. The idea is that you recognise there's something going on here that you don't understand. You try to grapple with that. And some of the criticisms levelled at Lewis include, well, you know, what about the history of Mercedes and, you know, funded by Nazis and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, it's irrelevant because that's the Mercedes of old, just like Bernie ran the Formula One of old. We're talking about now, and the Mercedes of now is not the Mercedes of then. The Mercedes of now is recognising what Lewis is standing for and trying to do something about it to support him. And other parts of Formula One are doing the same. Others are a bit slower. Everyone should really get behind Lewis, I think, and try to recognise where he's coming from rather than just ignoring it, sticking your fingers in your ears and hoping it will go away and that Formula One can remain unblemished by and untouched by politics. It's not the case. It's no longer a sport where a load of grubby mechanics and drivers turn up in a field and race around a track for a bit of money that a crowd brings in. It's a global, massive marketing TV platform, and politics and geopolitics are wrapped up intrinsically in that. And this is probably the start of many uncomfortable conversations that Formula One will have to have about its future on many different facets.
I mean, another little point that it's worth sharing with you, just because it was a personal insight for me. I was in Senegal in December, and I was speaking at a conference, and it was an almost entirely black African audience. And when I ask audiences in Europe how many business people follow Formula One, you know, it'll be probably a show of hands of maybe 10 or 20% who kind of like the sport. At that event in Senegal, in Dakar, I had a huge reaction. About 60% of the audience put their hands up. And I was really quite surprised, and they could see that. And I said, I'm going to ask you the obvious question. Why? And to a man and woman, they all said, Lewis Hamilton. He's an inspiration for our continent. And I thought, wow, I wish Jean Todt and, you know, Chase Carey were in that room to see this group of very successful business executives working for a big multinational company in Africa. And they follow Formula One because of Lewis. And I had a chat with some of them afterwards, and you could really sense the pride that they have. You know, here's a sport they feel has really opened its doors to them and to their culture. And I think that's a really very rewarding thing to gain an insight to. And I think, you know, we all acknowledge the fact that for all the globalization of Formula One, we don't, for example, have a Formula One race on the continent of Africa. And that's a kind of glaring point as well. You know, why not? You know, we're reading last week that by the end of this century, Nigeria will have the most affluent population in the world, and we have no presence in Africa. So there's, you know, really quite big macro issues here. And Ben, you know, the points that you made, you know, just absolutely spot on. And no doubt that for all the people who will be listening to this and people who follow us on social media, you know, all I would say is, you know, if you disagree, you know, everyone's entitled to their opinion, but we're all entitled to educate ourselves about these topics before we go lecturing anyone on them.
Yeah, absolutely. And Lewis is going to keep pushing on this subject as well. He said many times in the early part of the season since racing returned. I think it's interesting also that he was thinking about how to create greater diversity in Formula One before the Black Lives Matter protest really kicked off. He was talking in that in-house interview he did with Mercedes during lockdown that he wanted to work with the FIA on this. I think what's happened in America particularly has just accelerated that process and also given Lewis some fire to really start speaking up and using his platform in Formula One. And he's going to keep pushing and going to have to keep pushing with the support of others, because otherwise things won't change. You know, you mentioned sexism earlier, Mark, and, you know, we all recognise there's a gender pay gap across many industries, most industries, I might say, and that has closed. It's better now than it was, but it's still there. And if you just stop talking about these things and say, oh, it's not a problem, or I don't want to talk about it anymore, or we should shut up and get on with other things, these inequalities remain. It's only by challenging them, facing them, learning about them and doing something about them that you achieve progress.
Elsewhere in this month's GP racing, we take you properly behind the scenes of what it's really like to work at a Grand Prix in the COVID-19 era. I mean, obviously nobody needs to know what it's like for journalists because they document it at great length and with some tediousness on social media because they're sitting in the gilded cage of the media centre, well, not so gilded in the case of the Hungaroring. Motorsport Images had 6 people on the ground, including our principal photographer, Stephen T. And he's summed up the full experience of it in words and pictures. And Steve's been coming to Formula One races since San Marino in 1984, so he's very experienced. Steve says things aren't what they were, they what they are, which I think is a very realistic viewpoint to have on the way things are nowadays, where you're having something shoved up your nose every few days. And in the case of the Motorsport Images team, there are 6 of them, but only 4 of them in one bubble, and 2 of their colleagues are permanently in the bubble of the teams they're working with. And Steve says elsewhere in the issue in Parades that actually he was quite glad he wasn't with McLaren for the first 3 races, because it enabled him to go around circuits and kind of get a different view photographically and go to places that are unusual angles. And actually one of the Parades he went specifically to shoot for GP racing because he knew that it would never be used anywhere else because it was a landscape. So he was very pleased that Frank, our art editor, chose it. So yeah, it's very, very weird, isn't it, the way Formula One now works?
Yeah, I think I found it really interesting reading Steve's article. I've known him probably pretty well since about that time when he started working in Formula One. And I think the photographers do have a different take anyway on the sport just because of the way in which they have to go about their work and the way they build relationships. I mean, he talks in the feature about the trust that you have to build with teams and drivers as a photographer. And obviously now working in the kind of bubble that is created, there isn't the freedom of movement. The kind of press facilities are completely separated off. Not being able to go down and have a bite to eat with your team that you're working with or your friends in quite the same way. But I thought some really interesting points that came through in relation to, for example, the wisdom of the very first two races being in Austria. In a completely rural setting, so that makes it a lot easier. At the Red Bull Ring, which Dietrich Mateschitz and his staff at Red Bull have created a fabulous facility there, and then really raised the game in terms of preparing for these lockdown races, in terms of making sure that there's food for everyone, that the facility, yes, there's a bubble created, but you can get on with your job and you can deliver to it. And also the fact that I thought it was interesting that he, you know, Steve talks in the article about being able to take himself off, you know, to go and find somewhere up in the hills that they could go and swim in a lake or, you know, have a bit of fun away from the track. I kind of got the impression that they took a completely new view of turning up at the Red Bull Ring. It was not business as usual. It was business unusual. So they were going to do everything in a different way. And I think probably got quite a lot out of it. And my kind of final sort of point on having read that was, I mean, it's just one sentence that he throws in there, but he said, you know, having been there, he just has no idea why Charles Leclerc and Valtteri Bottas had to drive back to Monaco after the race. It was a perfectly acceptable place to spend a bit of nice quality time in and not run the risk of, you know, breaking the rules.
Breaking the integrity of the bubble. I mean, it seems odd to me that you would go to such great lengths to set up these very specific and, okay, tedious and perhaps sometimes unpleasant protocols to get racing going again, but they were done not only with the pragmatic aim of keeping coronavirus out of the Formula One paddock, but also to set an example for how you run a logistically challenging global sporting event safely amid a pandemic. And I kind of felt that, you know, everybody there had a responsibility, and I think the FIA even reminded people they had a responsibility to adhere to that, however it might seem that it's unnecessary for you personally. And yet you had obviously the incident of Sebastian Vettel and Messrs Horner and Marco chin wagging without face masks in the paddock, and they got it ticking off, but at least that's within the environment. And you know, everyone wearing masks all the time seems a bit silly, but it's about projecting that message of responsibility, isn't it, more than, you know, keeping everyone who's already tested negative safe from other people who've tested negative. But I found the moves of Leclerc and Bottas a bit over the top, really, to feel that they could just fly in and out as they pleased. You know, that adds risks to the whole process and kind of undermines the whole messaging that Formula One and the FIA was trying to put out by having all of these systems in place. Yeah, just kind of undermining the whole thing, really. I thought that was really unnecessary.
I can't get my head around why any of them thought that those were the right behaviours to put on, because what we're talking about here is Liberty working night and day to try and put together a world championship of hopefully 18 races or so in order that they get as much TV revenue in as possible so that these teams and drivers have got revenue next year from the prize fund. So we're talking about the financial stability of the sport being safeguarded by Liberty doing everything they can under the most extraordinary challenge that you know, professional sport has ever faced, bearing in mind, you know, there's never been a pandemic of this level in modern times. So professional sport has never witnessed this kind of a challenge. And so when you have team principals and drivers, effectively what they're saying is it doesn't apply to me.
Yeah.
It doesn't apply to me. I'm above it all.
Yeah. But it does, doesn't it?
And therein lies the problem. Because if there was an outbreak, if there was a proper outbreak in the paddock in Formula One, the countries who are currently negotiating with Liberty to bring Formula One in would just have to say, sorry, you can't come. It would be the end of the World Championship. And then everyone would be crying about the fact that there wasn't enough revenue coming in, and Liberty would be having, you know, crisis discussions with investment analysts and all the rest of it, and there would be a complete kickoff. I mean, it's not too much to ask people to wear masks. Nurses and doctors do it all day long. Dentists do it all day long. All we're asking is for the people in positions of authority to not just talk the talk, but to walk the walk by actually practicing what the sport is trying to preach to everyone. And one rule for me and one rule for everyone else comes across really badly.
Yeah, which is why we described it as F1's Dominic Cummings moment. That kind of taking liberty with the system, which is very F1 in some ways. Oh, I can exploit a loophole. I can extend my bubble to Monaco if I do it this way. I mean, that's very clever of you, Valtteri, but at the same time, there's a bigger picture at play. And also thought it was slightly disappointing that, having seen these breaches, that there wasn't perhaps more bite in the punishments meted out by the FIA and Formula One. I thought it was important that they take their own rules seriously enough to really punish people who transgress them. Otherwise, they're not really worth the paper they're printed on.
That's why we swerved on the original topic of the column. We were going to, I was going to sink my teeth into the ankle of Fernando Alonso's comeback, but then we were sort of having one of our video conference editorial meetings on a Monday morning, and we kind of just thought, well, actually, this is a bigger story, and shouldn't we be saying that Valtteri and Charles are flouting the regulations and have got away with it? It sends out a bad message. And would those two drivers have behaved in a similar way if there was a proper punishment sort of hovering over them? If Valtteri Bottas knew that if he was caught doing that again, then Stoffel Vandoorne would be in his car at the next Grand Prix, he wouldn't do it. If Charles Leclerc thought that Antonio Giovinazzi would be in his car at the next
Grand Prix, he'd definitely do it.
He'd say, tell you what, I'll have the weekend off. You can drive this pile of crap.
Yeah. He could go online and say, look, I've got a temperature spike and I'm coughing. And so I'm skipping the next few races. My goodness.
I'm skipping the next two seasons.
Can I drive your back of the grid car and you can drive my back of the grid car? Well, let's address that, shall we? Let's delve into that topic, because one of the strangest things about Grand Prix racing at the moment is how much of 2021 is being tied up. Even before the 2020 season began, we had Renault announcing Fernando Alonso as Daniel Ricciardo's replacement next year. We've got a rapid-fire Q&A with Cyril Abitbol, in which he talks a lot. Always feel sorry for the people who have to transcribe interviews with Cyril, because he talks a lot faster than his racing cars go. And also we have Ferrari admitting this week that basically 2021 is a write-off, and Fernando has told people that he's told Cyril that 2021 is a write-off. So who is going to actually benefit in 2021, do we think?
Mercedes and Racing Point.
Yeah,
like it's and Aston Martin. That's what they'll become, of course.
Well, we did say, and Ben rather meanly tweaked it to avoid us getting a little bit of heat from the silver stroke black team, where I described in the Hungarian Grand Prix as possibly looking like there would be the first Mercedes 1-2-3-4 since Aintree 1955. And we thought that maybe that would sound a little bit churlish.
So. Well, not proven yet, is it? Until we know the outcome of the protest, we don't know. It's either an excellent impression of last year's car, or it is last year's car. But we can't say for certain either way at the moment. But
We engaged reverse on that one, didn't we?
Yes. But the competitive picture is quite clear, isn't it? It's quite depressing. Although it's been great that Formula One is back and we've got racing to enjoy again, and the spectacle through the TV is not as disappointing or unusual atmospherically as it is the case with things like football, because of the engine noise and, you know, masking everything else. But in terms of the competitiveness of the championship, I mean, Ferrari have massively engaged reverse, I guess, caught secretly with their pants down by the FIA last year, or they can't show us what the tackle looks like because of that secret deal. So they've gone backwards and aren't in the picture at all. And as you mentioned, Codders, they're not going to be back in the game until 2022 at the earliest. So that's the biggest title challenges of the last two or three seasons gone. And then Red Bull seem to have completely messed up the RB16. Maybe that trick front suspension they fitted has messed up the aerodynamics, who knows. But they've got a lot of repair work to do. And the rules now limit the teams to only a handful of aerodynamic upgrades on the cars, or fundamental upgrades on the cars, for the next two seasons. So Red Bull aren't going to be in the same or have the same tools at their disposal to make up the lost ground as quickly as they might do normally. So it's just kind of handed the initiative to Mercedes, who also have been pushing hard themselves on the basis of, as Toto Wolff said, chasing a Ferrari car that a level of performance that was effectively unattainable under the rules. So had Ferrari not done what they'd done with their engines last year, probably Mercedes wouldn't be as competitive now as they are. And into that void have stepped Racing Point with the pink Mercedes, which has got everyone else up in arms. So I think we can look forward to more of those Mercedes-engined 1-2-3-4s for the next 18 months at least.
It's one of those rare moments where someone describes something as ironic, and it actually is ironic, unlike, I don't know, rain on your wedding day, 10 million knives when all you wanted was a spoon, all those things. Alanis Morissette, adumbrated, which were merely just inconvenient, or the result of poor cutlery procurement strategies. What do we make of Fernando's huge motivation that Cyril talks about? I think it's very strange to talk about huge motivation on the one hand, and a driver saying, well, actually, next year, you know, don't even bother with it, mate. On the other, it just seems very... There's what modern people like to say, a disconnect lurking in there.
Well, he's only coming back for the new rules, isn't he? You know, we carried a cover interview with Fernando at the start of the year before he had talks with Renault. So that process was underway. But we didn't yet know, obviously, where he'd be landing. And his aim was to come back for the original launch of the new rules, which was for 2021. Of course, that's been delayed because of the pandemic. But he spoke in that interview about how he had high hopes for that new rules package agreed between Formula One, the teams and the FIA, to properly close up the field and give many more teams a chance to be competitive. So that, in his mind, I guess, opened up his options. He didn't need to be necessarily in a Mercedes, a Red Bull, or at that time a Ferrari to have a chance of success. That might still turn out to be a naive position. But now those rules have been shunted back. He's still thinking, right, well, it's all about 2022. He's going to push Renault to write off the current car. I mean, the fact they've said they won't do any more engine upgrades for financial reasons means they're kind of already going down that path of writing off the next couple of years. As we've said in previous podcasts, it's about survival for everyone now. And of course, the teams who feel like maybe their business model structure, technical direction is aligning nicely with where Formula One is hoping to end up when these new rules come in, you might as well, seeing how far ahead Mercedes are, just burn everything up now and start work on that 2022 car as early as you possibly can. Alonso, you know, whether he has to wait one more year or not to be successful, it won't matter to him. He'd rather Renault got that new car absolutely right and gave him his best chance, considering he hasn't got many more years left at the top level, than, you know, chase another position in the Constructors' Championship in 2021, maybe a few more points, maybe a few better results, and compromise what they might be able to do the following season. So sensible from Fernando's perspective, but also from Renault's, because they haven't become the best team in the midfield, and they're not going to while the Racing Point Mercedes imitation car is so competitive. So they need to look beyond to try and redress the balance.
It came across to me, there were lots of kind of repeated phrases, and you know, he's trying to obviously communicate the fact that this is the right decision for him to have made, and for Renault, and for Fernando. And yet it's hard to get away from the fact that here's a driver who, whatever his talents, he's at the end of his career. And we're recording this podcast on the eve of his 39th birthday. So he will be 40 in the year that is now being called a transition year. He'll be 41 in the year, which he's now hopeful, you know, they will be able to be competitive. And yet we all know that even where you have rule stability, it takes 3 to 5 years to get to the front of Formula One. That's even when, you know, you know exactly where you're going and you've got everything that you need to do it in terms of the people and the structure and the drivers. And therefore, effectively, what is being discussed is that Renault, as is going to continue to be the fourth, fifth or sixth team next year and is then going to make a huge leap. And that's clearly just not going to happen. My personal view on it is it's great for Formula One that Fernando Alonso has come back in because he is such a big name. The very fact that we're talking about him again. He has a huge fan base. There are media who just worship the ground that he walks on. That he'll get a lot of column inches. He'll get a lot of airtime. You know, he's a go-to guy for his story, isn't he? So there's going to be a lot of Fernando Alonso coverage over the next couple of years, however he does, good, bad or indifferent. The reality is, of course, also that on a certain day, in certain conditions, in a particular race, he is a man who could probably get that Renault a very good finish. And, you know, who knows if he nicked a podium for Renault next year or in 2022, I suspect we'd all regard that as something of a triumph. So he doesn't even need to come back into the sport and go and win races. He just has to come back into the sport and do anything pretty good with that Renault. And I think he'll get a big round of applause from us. And just a final point, you know, as he heads towards his 40s, you know, 40 in his first year back at Renault, 41 in 2022, I mean, it's worth remembering that it's not impossible to be competitive in Formula One when you get into your 40s. And Michael Schumacher was a shadow of his former self when he came back into Formula One, but he'd been away for a few years. If you go and look at Nigel Mansell, when he came back into Formula One, he was still able to pull together a victory at the age of 41 in Australia. And so it is possible. And I'd even actually would argue that back in those days, I think the cars were even more physical to drive. And so from that point of view, I think a supremely fit Fernando Alonso, clearly, I mean, he is very motivated. What is he motivated by? I think he's motivated by unfinished business. I think he's motivated by coming back and saying, I've still got what it takes to be a competitor in this field. We don't know the financial deal, but I'm quite sure he's motivated by some of the commercial benefits that will come his way as a result of this. But I think overall, Fernando Alonso just loves Formula One. And I think the fact that he loves our sport so much and there are so many fans that love him, it's a good news story for him. And let's hope he does help Renault to make a step forward.
We should probably wrap this up now with a little bit of a discussion of stuff that's happened after between now and then. Then being when we pressed go, Apple P to send it to the printer. And you know, we leave the News Insider section to last to keep things as fresh as possible, but inevitably as soon as the last PDF has gone off to the printer, someone drops an announcement. And in the past few days we've had confirmation that there's not going to be a North American leg, and we'll have races at Imola and Nürburgring and Portimao, as well as the rounds that are announced at Mugello and Sochi. And I suppose, guys, the problem with the North American leg that we heard was that Canada were able and willing to host a race. The fact that it's likely to be below zero up there at that time of year, notwithstanding, but Formula One didn't actually want to go and have a race there on its own because of the costs involved. They wanted to have a race following that or before that at COTA, Mexico and San Paulo. But obviously, those territories are varying degrees of basket case at the moment. You know, you've got the mask dodging president of Brazil denying there's any problem when he's got coronavirus himself. So it's kind of tricky, isn't it? So we're going to have a very, very unusual season where there'll be a lot of records set at such as the Tuscan Grand Prix.
It's so unfortunate that just going back to our earlier point about the uncompetitive Ferrari, it's so unfortunate that they're going to have to race at home so many times with a really rubbish car, and you know, that's a real shame. But you know, I go back to my earlier point. I think Liberty are doing a magnificent job. I mean, they're pulling the metaphorical rabbit out of the hat here, aren't they, with race after race. And you can understand why the prospect of paying Montreal to host a race, because there'd be no spectators, paying Montreal to host a race, flying hundreds of tons of equipment over there only to come all the way back, just wouldn't make any sense whatsoever. And I think more races in Europe was always going to happen. I think it's great that a racetrack like Portimao, I've been there for an A1 Grand Prix race back in 2009. It's a great facility. We got a great welcome when we were there, albeit a decade ago. And then, you know, Nürburgring and Mugello, it's going to be so interesting. It's going to add a new dimension for all of us watching Formula One to see old circuits being brought back into use and tracks we've never seen Formula One on before. And frankly, we don't know what Formula One's going to be like at a couple of these tracks until we see it, despite all the best efforts of simulators and all the rest of it. So it's going to be an interesting one. And then, of course, I think we all know that off the back of this, the last group of races is now being put together to finish the season off through October, November, and into December, and it will have a very, very weird look to it when we see it all in the fullness of time. But at least Liberty are managing to do it, and I think, you know, I think really when the history of Formula One in 2020 comes to be written, people will reflect upon the fact that in the midst of complete carnage and chaos around the world, Liberty and Formula One were able to pull off a world championship in spite of everything and give all of us 16 or 18. Fun weekends of seeing who could battle their way into third place.
Now, Ben, have you driven cars at Portimao in your capacity as Autosport track tester? Have you been there?
Yeah,
he's nodding in his place.
Yeah, recently drove that circuit.
Lamborghini?
No, it was. I did some stuff with McLaren there in the GT cars, and also a open top sports prototype racing car as well. Fun circuit.
Which McLaren did you drive?
I drove the 600 long tail, and it's the 540 GT4.
Oh, they've got a model for every day of the week.
Yeah,
there's
loads.
Sunday best.
Yeah, it was one of their pure GT events, which they put on at various circuits around Europe and around the world. Actually,
And did you enjoy Portimao?
Oh, it's an incredible circuit.
The elevation changes were the thing that I really remembered, but I, you know, and I drove around there in the road car very slowly, but it must be fun to do it quick.
Yeah, it's a massively undulating circuit. How it looks to the outside, it's obviously accentuated when you're in the cockpit. It's quite demanding as well physically, because a lot of the corners are quite long radius, so and you don't get a lot of rest. You know, there's only one long straight really, and that comes off the back of a long corner, which should probably be easy flat in a Formula One car, but there's also some vicious bumps there as well, so it's quite a test for the car and for the driver. I think a few guys have done a fair bit of running in fairly recent Formula One machinery around there too, so it won't be a complete surprise for some, but it's a cool circuit and a nice country. I think the fact that, you know, these additional races have been added recently are all happening in Europe shows kind of the importance of the European heart of the world championship really in a crisis. Like Formula One's really depending on those circuits, and I know it's a unique situation and it's not the normal business model, but when Formula One needs help and needs places to go racing, like this is the best cost effective way to do it. Not so many of these far flung temporary venues that require a lot of logistical effort and money to get races to happen. And I don't know, there's other criticisms about, you know, would it be a world championship, will there be enough races for it to be considered a proper world championship, would it go to enough countries, but I think we need to forget that really. I mean, you know, in the early days of the world championship and really the first couple of decades, there were plenty of championships that were below 11 races, sometimes single figures. And, you know, Ross Brawn said before the season started they should probably relax the three continents rule in these exceptional circumstances. If they manage to get to the Middle East at the end of the season, that will be two continents. And of course, there's still talk of maybe at least one Asian race in the gap between the last European round in November and before they go to the Middle East. And that will even fulfill that criteria if they manage to do it. But I don't think really it matters too much if they do manage to do that. I think we should just kind of take each month as they come and hope we get as many races as we can. Of course, we don't know that the races that have been announced will necessarily even take place because the situation is still moving, and obviously things are happening in Europe now that put certain things under threat. So yeah, people need to chill out, really, don't they, when it comes to the calendar and the work that's going on, and you know how this season is never going to align with any other in terms of the historic narrative of Formula One. So just take it for what it is, as Stephen T would say.
I think we should really re-amplify, Mark, the point you made earlier about what a good job Liberty have done to put it together safely and put on some sort of show, because even though they're doing this because at the end of it there's a pot of gold in the form of the TV revenues, that they're all taking a huge bath in terms of the sanctioning fees. No bones about it. They are hiring these circuits out to put on a show there. No one's paying them to be there. There's none of the $50 million a year or whatever it is. So no wonder Stuart Pringle, who's the head of Silverstone, who's interviewed in our current mag, says, you know, basically that's what's happening. And none of these negotiations are easy, but at the end of the day, it came down to the fact that they wanted to put on a show, and we were able to, we Silverstone were able to put on that show. And certainly we GP Racing have heard that the teams have been informed that there's the possibility of a third Silverstone race if the situation in Spain goes further south than it had done a week ago. And duly, that situation has gone further south. And obviously, there's an exemption for elite sports, but things may change when the Foreign Office is advising against travel to a country. That's going to invalidate a lot of insurance, whether you have an elite sports status or not. So who knows? If we might get three Grand Prix at Silverstone this year, that would be a turn up for the books, wasn't it? How will they shake it up for the third time?
Don't allow the Mercedes to compete.
Well, I think it's really interesting that they're talking about having a 2-day event in Imola, aren't they? Mm. And just having practice and qualifying on the Saturday and then the race on Sunday. And I do feel that under these exceptional circumstances, now is absolutely the time for Ross Brawn to sit the teams down and say, we have to shake the sport up and do something different. So if there ever was a reason to run a reverse grid race, I think now's about it, because Mercedes are going to win the championship anyway. So maybe Toto Wolff should just let us all have a little bit of fun. Start Lewis at the back.
He's still going to win, though, isn't he? We could have all the remaining races as reverse grid races, and I think Mercedes would still win.
But the thing is, how much fun would we have watching Lewis carve his way through the field? How much fun would he have? And it would actually even more emphatically stamp Mercedes, you know, engineering excellence, if you don't want to put it that way. You know, instead of winning the race by 40 seconds, you win the race by, you know, 3 seconds, but having overtaken absolutely everyone. What a lot of fun that would be.
Not for the Mercedes
Toto,
engineers.
If you're listening,
I suppose the way to make it fair would be to make it a non-championship race, but given that there aren't that many championship races in this championship, they probably can't afford that. So it's tricky. It was certainly when W Series did it, it was a non-championship race, wasn't it? And that was a really good race, the W Series experimental one, and they should do that again.
They always are. I mean, if you fans of the British Touring Car Championship and its support package, you know, they have reverse grid races throughout the various categories on that bill, and they are always the best races, and usually the best drivers come through to the front or near the front in those races anyway, and it's a lot of fun to watch. But of course, you know, it does raise a question as to the purity of the championship and the scoring system, etc., when you're artificially handicapping the quicker people. So it depends always on whether Formula One values the spectacle more than the integrity of the sporting competition, shall we say. Everyone's got a different opinion, haven't they? But I agree with you, it'd be a lot of fun to see.
I think that is about it for this edition of Flat Chat. It's been fantastic speaking to you both. Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you.
We'll see
Thanks
you again
so
in a
much,
few weeks.
Thanks so
much, and our readers can look forward to more entertaining columns from you in the weeks to come. That is it, as I said, for another Flat Chat podcast. We'll be back in a few weeks' time. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for the patience and tolerance of Martin Lee, our producer. Thank you.